Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Marie, good afternoon.
Hi, Cormac. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, I know you didn't want this type of custom, Marie. You certainly didn't ask for this type of attention when you posted the ad. You're a business owner, I know. What's your business?
My business is Glossna House, Cormac. We are a support and holistic centre in the Midlands in County Laois. And part of the many treatments and services we offer would be our holistic services, although we are predominantly mental health.
Okay.
And it is as a result of our holistic services that I guess this whole story came about.
Okay. And what kind of holistic services do you offer, Marie?
So we have a team, a wonderful team of four holistic therapists, and they offer massage, reflexology, maternity treatments, Reiki healing, facials, cupping, all kinds of holistic treatments that focus on being and healing the body, I suppose. Very professional, highly trained women.
Okay, and a really professional service by all accounts as well. And I know the service and you in this area take great care. I mean, you're dealing with people's mental health and you want to provide the best service possible. You posted an ad recently, Marie.
Yeah, so regularly we would run advertisements across social media just to, I suppose, let more people know about the Glossna House social medias. And one of the ads we posted was advertising a special offer our massage team offer. And sadly, what happened as a result of that ad was a huge spike or an increase in the inappropriate and misogynistic contacts from males.
What do you mean?
It was so disappointing.
What do you mean, inappropriate and misogynistic contacts from males?
So I'll give you a perfect example. So this service that we provide and advertise is a professional service by very professional, highly trained, educated women. And the response to the ad is generally fantastic, but then you do have this increase where people are asking you, does that come with a happy ending? Can I see photographs of the massage therapist, the female massage therapist, before I book? Can I get an appointment at 7 p.m. on a Sunday? And does it include a relationship? Sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but does this include a happy ending? That's just to give you a sample. But in one day, Cormac, we had received seven of these types of requests. And I found it just deeply upsetting, and it really enraged me as well that it's 2025 and women working in the holistic healing and massage field are dealing with this on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I suppose what's different for me is that all our calls and messages go through our reception. So our massage therapists aren't looking at these and dealing with these. But the sad reality is, across Ireland, massage therapists generally work alone. So I suppose, to give you an idea, it would be a female therapist in a room alone with a client. So it's a very intimate setting.
And it's a vulnerable
setting. So they would also answer their phone calls. That's the word.
Yeah. Can I go back there?
And
my goodness gracious me. I would ask other people who provide holistic or therapeutic services if they've come across this type of, I don't want to know, we'll call it customer, this type of contact from, you say from males, that does it come with a relationship? Can I get an appointment at 7 p.m. on a Sunday? Is that code for something?
Yeah, and the words like, does it come with a relationship? But even asking for photographs of the therapist before they book, or, you know, we're very good here at fielding these calls. We run a very tight ship, Cormac, so there's a screening process. But even some of the examples, because after I shared a post, I basically shared a post saying, don't contact us if this is what you're after. And just how upsetting it was to our team.
You had to say, I mean, is, I'm afraid to ask this almost, but does it come with a happy ending? Is that as gross as I think it is?
That's absolutely as gross as you think it is. And it's not just, by the way, it's not just calls and messages. This stuff happens in massage businesses all over Ireland, not Glossna House because of the screening we have and the tight ship we run. But underneath the Facebook post, the amount of massage holistic therapists all across Ireland who shared personal experiences from having to close down their business because they didn't feel safe. Because what happens is if you just get one text message, that unnerves you. Mm. And you then have to go to work that evening and you're working alone in a room. It's really going to unnerve you. And, you know, we as women deserve, at the very least, is to feel safe in our place of work. Mm. So it's having a really bad impact in that respect. But more so, it's preventing women from earning a living. So if your business is massage and holistic therapies and you've spent thousands and thousands training and then you go into this career and this is what you're faced with, it's terrible, because what it does is it really puts you off. Like, underneath the Facebook post, Cormac, there's people saying, I trained for however many years and after 2 months in business, I had to step away because I was just too nervous, or I just felt too under siege by all these messages. Because there's real life stuff that happens in the rooms as well. If you want, I can share a story with you. Where a female massage therapist, 22-year-old female massage therapist, very new in the world of massage, just qualified, and very excited about getting her career going, managed to get a job in a hotel in Kildare. And one of the male guests of the hotel booked in for a massage through the system. She was the massage therapist, and towards the end of the treatment, he put 20 quid on the locker beside the massage table and said, that's for the happy ending. This 22-year-old woman left the room and never went back to work again.
Well done,
and,
her.
And you see, that's actually what's happening. Absolutely. But that's what's happening. It's well done for her walking out. But then what does she do in terms of all her training, her career, everything that she's put,
well, that story,
you know, her
Marie,
heart and soul into?
That story has frightened me a little bit, because what I was looking at and hearing from you was that all of this was in relation to an ad. So these were requests via social media. So it happens sometimes during the service.
It does. You will see, I have a team of four female massage therapists here, or holistic therapists, should I say. And they've had experiences where, for example, a male client has put their hand over their hand whilst they're massaging them and saying, you're too beautiful to do this work. So that's very creepy and unnerving. And again, think of it, it's 8:30 of a rainy evening in November and you're alone in the room with this male.
And how did they react?
They left the room, as they are trained to do in Glossner, and got me. And the person's told to leave the premises and never come back.
Any aggro?
No. Mortified they were, and good enough for them. But again, it's our therapists here are protected from that. That was a once-off.
Again,
when you don't have somebody to come in and have your back, that's the fear, I think, out there. And what I would really like people to hear is that these are your daughters, these are your wives, these are your friends, these are your sisters, these are your mammies. These are strong, independent, working women whose ability to earn is being restricted because of this treatment by males. And I'd love males to join the conversation.
Well,
males
would as
to
well.
Say, this is not acceptable.
I would as well, I must say. I would as well. Because if any male threw down 20 euro to any female working professionally in my life and said to her, that's for the happy ending, well, my God, I would want to know what the hell he's thinking. What the hell he's thinking.
It is awful. And the amount of businesses that have closed because of it, Cormac, and the amount of therapists who will say, I trained for however many years, I went into business, and after 6 months or a year, I'm now training in a different field because it's just not worth it. It's just not worth the abuse. I call it for what it is. It is abuse, and it's a form of, it's a scare tactic as well. It's just everything about it is insidious.
But have you heard of any other, and I'm sure you have, you've referred to it there, Marie, and I'd love to hear, by the way, from men, but also from other holistic or therapeutic services around the country, if they have the same stories as you. So you think this is abuse? I think you're probably right. It's certainly, you know, it's a power, it's
abuse.
A power play.
It
would you
abuse.
Agree, Marie, as well?
Yeah, it is a power play. And it's very intimidating when you're on the receiving end of it, because it is unnerving. And if you think of it like this, if you are a massage practitioner, your address will be public as well. Mm-hmm. And if you operate from your home. So, you know, there's so much attached to this. And I'm often asked, you know, well, what can we do about this? What can we do to change this? And there's only one answer, really, and that's for everybody, men and women, to come together and say, this is not acceptable. And, it starts earlier than somebody phoning up and making one of these calls or terrifying a massage therapist in a room. It starts with the remarks, the comments, the looks. You know, oh, look at your one. Those kind of things, they need to be stopped by men. I suppose the common term would be locker room talk. But yeah. I mean, I'm a woman. I'm in business. I'm in my 40s. I've been in business my whole life. And I've experienced misogyny, the looks, all of that. Actually, even in terms of just generally. But because of the nature of the work of holistic and massage therapists, it just makes their environment more vulnerable.
But you've never, you've described very well how your staff member experiences. You've never had any personal experience of this type of misogynistic or inappropriate behaviour, Marie, have you?
No, just because I'm not a massage therapist, no, I haven't been in a situation. I'm actually a psychotherapist, okay. Cormac.
And so
I support people from a mental health perspective.
I understand. And all of these services, by the way, by God, people could not live their lives given the stress that people experience in their daily lives. People could not function. People could not function without these services in terms
They're
of mental
so
health
vital.
And holistic.
And well-being. And that's what I suppose that's what's deeply sad about all of this is that the women working in this area by nature are very kind, caring and given human beings. That's who they are. That's what they're about. So they're very passionate about this work and helping people. So it's even more difficult to get such a slap in the face then when that's what you're set out to do and you're literally getting abused because of the work that you do, highly skilled work.
Would you like, Marie, to hear from others in your profession, other therapeutic
services?
Absolutely. I mean, a little bit of solidarity, I suppose, because you say it's more common than we think. WhatsApp, by the way, 087-484-8888. You say there's an increase in this type of behaviour.
There is an increase in this type of behaviour, and I think getting the 7 messages in one day, Cormac, was a real testament to that. But more so, like I said, when I did write about it publicly on Facebook, just the experience that I had and how I didn't want it to happen in my centre or to the team that work here, so many people wrote underneath the post and so many people messaged me privately as well and just shared their experiences and how they don't answer calls anymore. Imagine having a work mobile phone and not answering calls.
Yeah,
and the reason they don't answer calls is they want to make sure. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying it's certainly not good for business. I'm saying flippantly in a joking type of way, but it's not sustainable.
Absolutely.
But can I ask you this?
Absolutely. It's almost laughable because it's so outrageous that in 2025, we as women have to deal with this.
Would a male masseuse get a similar request, do you think?
No, a male masseuse would not get a similar request. And unfortunately, a male masseuse would probably get less clientele.
Why?
Because I think in the holistic world, and even in the mental health world, women are just, there's more women in the field. So if you have a male massage therapist, we've had a male massage therapist here before, but I think the area they generally work on more so is the sports injury side, the deep tissue side. I suppose they call it around these parts a rub, where it's like you've played sports or, you know, you need your muscles particularly looked after. So you wouldn't get, well, in my experience, which is limited because, like I said, we've only ever had one male massage therapist here. In my limited experience, no, they wouldn't get these kind of calls.
Okay.
They wouldn't get these kind of requests.
It's mostly females. Will you stay on the line there, Marie? Emily, good afternoon.
Of course
I will. Hi, how are you?
Say hello to Marie there.
Hi, Marie, how are you?
Good.
In the same situation. I've been in this industry for 20 years now, and from day one, when I was quite young, I suppose, I used to get these calls, and they used to actually make me physically shook. I used to be shaking after them and just upset afterwards and crying. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe somebody just said that to me on the phone. I'm a bit older and wiser, I just feel them straight away and I cut them off. And sometimes I think I do cut off legitimate clients as well, because I just, as soon as I hear anything that's heading towards what type of massage do, I'm nearly cutting them off at that point.
Really?
Because anytime I advertise, like you say, I do holistic massage, but I also do sports massage. So I will only advertise now that I do sports massage because of those requests that I get.
It keeps the wolf at bay, so to speak.
But you still get them. You will always get them.
When you say you get these type of calls, Emily, what do you mean by that?
The type of calls, they always start off with what type of massage. And I ask them then where they got my number. It used to be that they would get my number from Golden Pages back in the day. So I don't know where they used to just ring from Golden Pages. Mm-hmm. But now I barely advertise online because of it. It doesn't matter how legitimate your business looks, you'll still get these calls, and probably most of the calls I get from unknown numbers, that's what they would be.
And you're shook by them.
I'd even get those calls, and like I could be doing my shopping with a kid in a trolley, you know, I'm there with my kids and I'm getting these calls.
And somebody asking you for a happy ending.
I get them on Christmas Day. I presume there's lonely men out there. Christmas Day there's always a couple of calls on Christmas Day. So it's just,
And Emily,
unfortunate, it's something that...
I mean, that is when you kind of contrast you doing your shopping with your kid and on the other line, a male asking you for inappropriate. So you say you feel physically sick. What is the impact? Describe to people, describe to those males, Emily, how it makes you feel.
Just makes you feel kind of violated. It's it's like you're trying to just get, do a bit of advertising and get new clients. And you end up feeling like, you know, you're in the sex industry and you're out there providing a different type of service altogether. And it's just not nice at all.
That's how you feel as a professional, skilled, trained masseuse. You feel sometimes, because of how you're treated, like you're in the sex industry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, well-meaning people, when they hear what I do, will always have a little, they might have a little snigger, and the same joke, it's always the same joke. Oh, do you provide happy endings kind of thing? And like, I know they don't mean anything by it, it's just a silly little joke, but it kind of brings up all those times you have been asked over the phone. I've other people, colleagues that I work with, and they've been asked in person. I haven't, thankfully. But, it just brings that back up. So you try to smile and laugh it off, but at the same time, you feel your stomach just goes into knots because it's bringing up that stress of having to deal with those phone calls.
And has it ever happened to you during one of your massages where somebody asks for something inappropriate or does something inappropriate?
I have never, no, thankfully not, no. And
do you fear it, Emily?
I would have to, I field people, I suppose. I'd be very careful about who I'd have here, you know. So, it would always be a worry. And certainly I know colleagues of mine have worked in hotels and in other industries, and it happened because I suppose there's people coming in that you don't know. I would have I'd have people's phone numbers and addresses and emails before they even get here.
Okay.
So... I would have fielded them, so thankfully no, but that's why I do that.
And when you have a client or a customer come in and it's a man, is there a change in mindset or psychology for you as a masseuse as opposed to a woman customer?
Maybe a little bit, but generally most men that I see, you know, are just normal men. They're fine. They're not a bother. But it's just those phone calls and trying to get new business and trying to advertise is the problem because you have to feel those phone calls.
Mm-hmm. So you're not looking.
I think that's really important there, what Emily said about trying to get new business.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to build your business, this kind of behavior is preventing that. It's reducing female massage therapists' ability to earn and to raise their profiles.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just say one other thing about the joke about, you know, oh, do you provide happy endings? It's not funny. You don't need to laugh and smile. It's not funny. And, you know, it's disgusting, actually, because it's showing that society, you know, we're saying, oh, it's okay to say these things. It's not okay to say these things. And that's where we need to nip it in the bud. So if two guys are talking, they're having a beer and they're having a chat, and then one says, oh, I went for a massage the other day, and the other friend goes, and did you get a happy ending? The first friend needs to say, don't say that. That's just not appropriate. Don't say that. It's not funny. And besides, my wife is a massage therapist. My sister is a massage therapist. My daughter is a massage therapist. Don't you dare.
I mean, do other massage therapists feel like that? 51551. I mean, do other massage therapists around the country experience, or have you, here's the question really, because maybe this has always been the case, you get the odd call, but what you're saying, Marie, is that there's been an increase in this type of inappropriate contact and misogynistic behaviour. I'd love to know. It's liveline at rte.ie is the email address. The funny thing, and you've both mentioned it, you're generating business. You are business people, mm-hmm. you're entrepreneurs, you're risk takers, you're generating wealth. And when I talk to Pascal Donoghue or Jack Chambers after the budget, and I'm talking about income tax and corporate tax, it is that the small and medium-sized businesses like yours that we're talking mm-hmm. to. But I mean, the fact that you feel mm-hmm. violated and part of the sex industry, Emily, have you ever thought about leaving the industry?
I have, yes. Yeah, no, I have. But look, at this stage, I'm kind of have my client base and I have changed it slightly so that I don't have to deal with these kind of calls. But, you know, and it's only myself. I'm not having anybody else work for me. So Marie there has a bigger problem because she's dealing staff. With other therapists and trying to field calls for her.
Okay, look, I'll tell you one thing. You've done us a service, I must say, because we are getting calls, 51551 in contacts.
Fantastic.
I would wonder if there are even more holistic and masseuse and therapeutic services experiencing this type of inappropriate behaviour. Do you provide a happy ending, and do you have an appointment at 7 p.m. on Sunday? God almighty. Marie, Emily, thank you very much indeed. After the break, we'll hear from soldiers who served in the Lebanon.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
A proud Irish peacekeeping tradition in the Lebanon could be wound up, and very soon indeed. Johnny, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you? And thank you for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure to speak with you. You served 9 tours of duty, is that right?
That's right, yeah. In my career of 16 tours altogether, I'd served 9 in Lebanon between the years of 1980 and 2000. And I would have visited Lebanon in 2007 and 11 and 19 on work parties, updating comms equipment for the missions that were out there then. Yeah, so in all, nearly 8 years service would have been spent coming and going to Lebanon.
And I want to ask you about the work you did, Johnny, in just a second. But I want to get your reaction to the possibility of the peacekeeping mission in Lebanon involving Irish troops for nearly half a century, I think. That could be wound up very soon. What's your reaction?
Yeah, it's sad that it has come to this because we put in a lot of time. We've lost 47 mm-hmm. soldiers to the mission in Lebanon. And while it has been batted around for the last couple of months in the news, you knew the moment was coming because of the situation with Israel and America backing Israel and not getting the vote through yesterday to carry on the mission. Yeah.
And my thoughts, I must say, immediately when I heard this on the news this morning, went to the 47, the families of the 47 Irish soldiers who lost their lives over the years. I wonder how they feel today, Johnny.
Yeah, and like we have a monument in Tibnin, and every month there's a mass and a read-led ceremony to remember those guys. And we have veterans organisations, the Irish United Nations Veterans Organisation, which I'm a member of, and ONE. And we make sure that we look after those guys that have served and might be in need of support, and those have passed on who have served, that they're not forgotten. And they are forever in our thoughts and our memories.
Well said, well said, because I'd love to hear from those families today in terms of reaction to this news, that this honourable tradition of peacekeeping and Irish soldiers serving 9 tours in your situation, Irish soldiers giving their lives. Even I'd love to hear from those families, I must say. Can I ask you, Johnny, about the actual day-to-day work of an Irish peacekeeper in the Lebanon?
Yeah, and a lot of people ask me this down through the years, like, why do you travel to Lebanon, such a far-off place and hostile place? But at home, young soldiers, they train, they get upskilled. In my case, I was communication, so it was signals, and I would have trained in all the different signal equipment relevant to that time and those missions. And like, when I'm going back to 1980, it was laying telephone lines across wadis and maintaining those lines. And, you know, you spend maybe 2 days walking wadis, meeting the locals while they're getting in their harvest. And we are known and seen and became part of the local community with our presence out there. And to a young soldier, at home you train, but when you go on a mission to overseas, it's like you get to run the race. It's that you've trained at home, but now you have to perform your talent, your skill, your expertise. And people rely on you, whether you're an engineer, you're a guy in transport, your signals. You don't go home at 4:30 like you do or 5 o'clock in the evening.
You're always
home. You're living with these people that you're providing a service for. And it's that satisfaction of doing your job and that you're getting the result for the community of people that you're with while providing escorts and security convoys in the mission area looking after
people. It's honourable work, as I say. How dangerous did it get, Johnny, for you?
Well, believe it or not, in the early days, because communications weren't like we have today with mobile phones, there was shelling and attacks going on constantly. And if you remember back in the early 80s and late 90s, you had Major Saad Haddad. He was the commander of the DFF, which were a buffer, Christian buffer force that the Israelis had in Lebanon. Mm. And they were, if you like, the smoke alarm. If the Hezbollah were going to make any attacks, they'd attack the compounds of the DFF, who were Lebanese Christian people, which were supported by Israel. And that was ongoing. There was always conflict, always in every mission, ongoing.
And it was dangerous. If there were to be a surprise attack or a resistance group attack or a militant attack, there could have been a huge bombardment from the Israelis as well. I mean, this was dangerous on both sides.
It was, because you had overspill fire, but also the people that are operating the equipment with the militia weren't experts on how to operate the equipment. Mm-hmm. And they would come up behind the UN post, fire Katusha rockets at the compound. The compound would open up the DFF compound, and they didn't care where the rounds were landing. They just retaliate. And sometimes they hit the UN positions. And in particular, I know in the signals billet where I was housed once, a tank round went through the billet.
Oh, God.
And we had two guys, luckily, they were only injured, but they weren't critical.
So extremely dangerous at all times for the 6 months that you were there. Stay with me, Johnny. Larry, good afternoon.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Cormac.
You're very welcome. You served as well, Larry?
I did. I'd done 7 tours there, Cormac, between 1989 and 1999.
Okay. Well done. And in terms of, and I'll ask you about that in a second, but in terms of your reaction to the fact that this could be wound down, this honourable peacekeeping Irish tradition in the Lebanon, what's your reaction?
Well, I think it opens up another conflict, because Hezbollah will have free reign in South Lebanon, as will Israel, and we could be looking at another Gaza in the south of Lebanon, right up to the Litani River. That's what I predict, that the Israelis will go in again, like they did in 1978, right up to the Tani River, which is 20 kilometres inland.
Why
set up a new buffer zone?
Well, you're predicting all hell then, breaking loose.
Yeah, well, that's my opinion on it, that I think that they're going to move in again to the Litani River to keep Hezbollah back.
Israel
will, yeah.
And they can't at the moment because of the peacekeeping mission, is that it?
They can't because the peacekeeping mission is in place there. And the UNIFIL resolution 1701 is looking for all foreign armies out of Lebanon and armed militias.
So you really believe, Larry, that the Irish soldiers and the UNIFIL mission in Lebanon is actually keeping the peace? I mean, it's very often thrown away as a comment, but it's securing peace in the region in that part.
definitely securing peace. Where I see the downside of the UNIFIL mission would be the Lebanese armed forces. They're not fit for purpose at the moment. Now, I know they're trying hard to disarm the Hezbollah and stop Hezbollah coming into the UNIFIL area, but they are getting through. And they'll always get through because these guys will be using Mahdis, they'll be watching Lebanese armed forces patrols, they'll watch the UNIFIL patrols, they'll monitor the radio networks. So they know exactly where UNIFIL and Lebanese armed forces troops are. So they can avoid them and get in.
And of course, see, this is a difficulty. It's becoming, and has become over the last 15 months or so, far more dangerous. I mean, the UNIFIL may have secured peace in that area for a long time, but as we know in recent months, there has been warfare, there has been attacks and missiles and ground invasions and so on. Larry, stay with me. Kevin is also on the line. Good afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon, Cormac.
You served?
I did indeed. I had 3 tours of duty with UNIFIL and I had 2 tours of duty with UNSO, which is the other UN organisation in the area comprising of unarmed military observers.
Okay. And if UNIFIL is withdrawn, what could the consequences be, in your opinion?
I think, as Larry said there, I think they'd be quite significant because the capabilities and capacities of the LAF aren't fully there. And one of the things that UNIFIL has been doing is been supporting the LAF, both in terms of trying to get funding for equipment and in cross-training. And also, I might add, the maritime component of UNIFIL operates in conjunction with the helping to train and further develop the capabilities of the Lebanese Navy.
Do you think it was winding up to a position, the geopolitical situation now, and negotiations, let's call them that, at the UN, at UN level, were we always leading, do you think, Kevin, to a point where this withdrawal could be on the cards?
Well, the goal of UNIFIL was always to hand over their capabilities and tasks to the Lebanese authorities. But to ensure that they're in a position to do so, we need to be a bit pragmatic on the timeline because, yes, they're increasing the training and the capabilities of the LAF. But certainly, as Larry said, I think if UNIFIL is there, no, of course, UNIFIL can't protect everything. But the areas that UNIFIL operate in are safer than other areas. Mm-hmm. And as Larry quite rightly pointed out, one of the roles is that UNIFIL provides is observation. And that was one of the reasons that we had the tension back some time ago when the IDF more or less surrounded an Irish platoon position, 6-52. Because unlike what's happening in Gaza, the UN has eyes on the ground in South Lebanon, which is an important part of their tasking.
Mm-hmm. You as a soldier, Kevin, over the years, you must have seen some attacks and vicious, violent behaviour over the years in Lebanon.
I have, yeah. And I think the Chief of Staff might have mentioned earlier this morning, who incidentally I served with in Lebanon as an observer during the war in 2006. But he mentioned that that the Irish Defence Forces have lost 46 soldiers died serving with UNIFIL and a further one was killed serving with UNSO. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what the level of violence that certainly I've experienced there, I was there during a 7-day war in 1993. I was there during another 7-day war in 1996, and I was there as a military observer with my wife and young family in 2006. And we had a strength of 52 military observers, and in 3 days, we lost over 10%. We had one Australian captain seriously wounded. She was eventually evacuated with my wife and kids. We had an Italian captain shot in the back, he's now in a wheelchair, and the Israelis fired a bunker-busting missile into a post of ours in Kiam, killing 4 very good friends of mine. So Yeah, I've seen like most Irish veterans, yeah. we've all kind of had our own experiences in Lebanon.
And do you remember on days like this, Kevin, when it's in the news, do you remember those four friends that were killed?
I remember them. There's not a week would pass that I wouldn't remember them. It was on the 25th of July in 2006, and despite repeated warnings that they were firing too close, and everyone, both UNIFIL in Lebanon, UNSA headquarters in Jerusalem, and UN headquarters in New York, were telling the Israelis to stop targeting this particular post. And they eventually fired a JDAM, which is a bunker busting missile, into it. And ironically, that post had the best bunker in Lebanon because it had been completely destroyed 20 years earlier. So when they built it, to withstand all sorts of artillery. But no one was, like, the roof of the underground bunker was about a metre and a half of reinforced steel and concrete with a two-storey concrete building above it. So you can imagine the effects of a JDAM when it goes through all that amount of concrete.
And the power of it, yeah.
As I said, killed four very good friends of mine.
My goodness, yeah. And not a week goes by, you say, without you thinking of them. Stay on the line, Kevin, if you can, please. Michael,
yeah.
Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
You did over 20 years in the Navy. You served in Lebanon.
Yes, I served there for one term in 1994 to 95, with the main Irish contingent was the 76th Battalion, mm-hmm. but we were with, I was in the Nakura headquarters down near the coast.
You'll have to bear with me here, Michael, because you're talking to someone who never had the privilege or the courage, I must say, to serve in Ogle na Héireann. What motivated you? Why did you volunteer to serve in the Lebanon, can I ask?
I think there's a part of anybody that serves their country in the defence forces, part of them that also wants to contribute some way, if they can, to world peace. And that certainly would have been my motivation, to have contributed in some way towards making somebody's life a little bit safer. Mm-hmm.
And you were willing to do that despite knowing the danger of it, Michael?
Well, I think every person of the Defence Forces knows from the, you know, from the time they enlist or go in as cadets or whatever, that there is an inherent danger in the profession that you've chosen. That's something that everybody would be conscious of from the very beginning. You are, you know, trained at the use of lethal weapons and so on, and defensive measures and all of that. Mm-hmm. So you would be aware of that. But I think in terms of peacekeeping, in my view, and I have to take my hat off to all of those in the Army, the Air Corps, the Navy, who did multiple missions in different parts of the world. They were, you know, in my view, people that should be looked up to, highly motivated, and made a real contribution to world peace. And what that meant in ordinary terms, it's not just some global aspiration. The soldiers that served in South Lebanon created safety for communities that were able to farm, that were able to go to school. Where, if they weren't there, if the peacekeeping force wasn't there, that may not be possible for them, or it would be very, very dangerous for them. Irish soldiers even went and built an orphanage in one of the areas in the hills there, that they built with their labour, with their spare money and everything else, and developed fabulous relationships with local communities.
And when you're building orphanages and schools and services and interacting with the locals, as Irish people with their natural charisma can do, it's no wonder how welcomed you were. But can I ask you, you mentioned something else, or I think it was Kevin that mentioned something else. And I'll come back to Larry for a second. Stay with me, Michael. Kevin mentioned, Larry, that he observed violent, vicious attacks, and he described some of them. Now, it strikes me, having studied this over the years in terms of news, that an awful lot of people, maybe at various sides, do not want independent observers there. And your point that all hell will break loose, what happens if the independent observers of UNIFIL are not there?
well, there's no one then, Cormac, to police the situation as such, because we're there as a barrier to atrocities. Like, when I went out to UNIFIL first, our main weapon, believe it or not, was a camera that we were able to record if the Israelis done something, the South Lebanese army done something, or even Hezbollah. We had the camera. We have photographic evidence of a war crime. But if the observers are gone, that is gone.
And that's a frightening thought, I must say. And then, Kevin, there's a question of what now for the Defence Forces if they can't put their hands up, the Irish soldiers we have at the moment, and say, I want to go to Lebanon to serve, to serve global peace and so on. What do you think this means for the Irish Defence Forces, for Ogilvy na Héireann, Kevin?
I think it's quite significant, because deploying to Lebanon, whether you're a young soldier, a junior NCO or an officer, the opportunity to serve overseas in robust peacekeeping missions is a very effective training tool for the Irish Defence Forces. And it prepares them for, maybe possible deployments to more robust missions, such as, we'll say, the mission in Chad was, or in Liberia, which are Chapter 7 peace enforcement missions. But certainly it's a great training ground, probably isn't the right word, but it's a great training experience, especially in terms of leadership and in terms of how people operate under stress.
And can I ask you, Johnny, if this were to happen, the end of the Irish peacekeeping mission in the in Lebanon, the UNIFIL, would it diminish the Irish Defence Forces, in your opinion?
No, definitely not. I think
The line is terrible. I'll try and improve that line if I can at all, and apologies to you, Johnny. Michael, I'll ask you that. Could it diminish the offering even of the Irish Defence Forces?
No, I don't think it would diminish the professionalism of the Defence Forces anyway, and there are lots of other missions around the world maybe where, you know, that they are currently involved in, some of whom don't require as much in terms of numbers, but I don't think it would diminish. It certainly is very beneficial for soldiers to be exposed to an environment where there's ever-present danger and undertake some of the missions that they did take. It's a dangerous place, and as we keep remembering the 47 that died out there, there's always that ever-present danger. And, you know, it's almost, you know, unthinkable to think, oh, that's a benefit, you know, that we're exposed to all of that.
No, I know what you mean, but there is, there's a proud history, though.
The sort of training,
there's a proud history, as I said.
The training that they get before they go.
Yeah. The question I was going to ask is, there's a proud history, and people, I think Irish people generally are proud of Irish soldiers who serve as peacekeepers. I know locally in Galway there's a soldier, and it's almost like a badge of honour that you throw at him. You say he served in the Lebanon. I don't know if you get that generally.
Well, it is an honourable thing, and you know, I still, although I'm gone from the Navy, you know, almost 30 years at this stage, 27 years, on formal evenings and formal functions, I still wear my medal that I got from Lebanon. I'm proud of that, and proud of all the others that went out there so often.
And well done, and well you should. But Larry, in a way, isn't that the answer? I mean, that will no longer be available, possibly, to Irish soldiers.
No, the UNIFIL mission will go, but it'll go eventually. I don't think it's going to... I know it's mandated until the 31st of December next year, but and then a slow-phased turnaround. And I hope it's very slowly phased out, if it's going to go that way.
Okay.
But there will be other mission areas that Irish troops can deploy to.
Lucas,
could I just make one point before Kevin, you finish up, and just to zoom out a small bit? And Michael will be interested in this one. UNIFIL is the only peacekeeping mission to establish a permanent maritime boundary between two countries which are still at war, i.e. Lebanon and Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, they haven't fully established the land boundary. The blue line is in place, which is a frontier rather than a boundary. But in 2022, under the auspices of UNIFIL, Israel and Lebanon agreed to formally end their maritime boundary dispute. Now, of course, the reason for this is off the northwest coast of Israel and the southwest coast of Lebanon, there are enormous gas fields. So that probably prompted it. But it shows that UNIFIL can be very successful in certain areas.
Okay. Somebody else wanted to get in really briefly?
Yeah, Cormac, Johnny here.
Johnny, go on, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, and you're just saying going forward, if Lebanon is gone, for young soldiers joining, you know, we're involved in the EU battle groups, and that's a journey that's about to start rather than end as well, because going forward with the Ukraine situation, we can reply on or we can deploy under the EU flag. And we've been involved in the battle group since 2007.
Okay. So there are other options as well. Well done to you all. Thanks for coming on, and thank you for your peacekeeping service over the years. I think an awful lot of people up and down the country are proud, genuinely proud of you. Michael, Johnny, Kevin, Larry and others. Mida Buchis, Liv. We'll take a very quick break. We'll be back with the secretaries and caretakers on strike today.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Strike at the school gates, strike at the Dáil in Dublin City as well. The school secretaries and the caretakers were on strike today, as you know. Noreen, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you doing?
Not too bad. You're on the road very early this morning.
Absolutely. Some people on my bus were up at 3 o'clock this morning, 3:30. They started their road from Kinmare. They started the journey up from Kinmare, and myself, we left around 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And we got here in loads of time.
Now, it is a serious subject, but can
very
I
serious.
Say, you sent us a video of you all, school secretaries and caretakers, on the school bus. Can I say that you were like an unruly class on the way up, Noreen? Can I play this for people? Let's have a listen to the school secretaries and the caretakers preparing for a strike on the way up.
Strike, strike, strike! Now, now, now! Pension, pension, pension! Now, now, now! Strike, strike, strike! Now, now, now!
And on it went. Look, in a way making a joke, but this is serious stuff. What was the atmosphere like when you got to strike in Dublin?
It was electric. We had over 2,500 people marching together for the common good, for the one thing that we're all looking for: pension, pension, pension. Now, now, now. We were blown away, and I'm just waiting now for the bus to take us all home. There's about maybe 10 buses. The Galway bus is ready to depart, and we're waiting now for the Cork bus to come along and take the rest of us home.
My goodness, you're going all the way down to
Cork.
Do you think you were heard, Noreen?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The whistles, we had whistles, drums and great music. But it's funny, we were outside the office of Depender and we saw the windows closing. So let that not be a sign to us. It was colourful and loud.
And stay with me, because there are others as well. Esther, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cormac.
You're very welcome to the programme again. You're a school secretary, of course. You were on strike as well in Dublin today.
Yes, we're on strike on the road since early. Buses from every corner. It was massive and a great success.
And on the road early as well, from as far as Donegal in your case.
Yes, well, I'm from Leash. Yeah. I'm from the home of Electric Picnic, so it's hard to get out there, I can tell you. But,
I'll tell you, you've colleagues, I know you're Leash, but you've colleagues who've travelled from Donegal, I think, up really early as well.
Yeah.
But
there
tell me
from
this.
Donegal
sorry to cut across you, but the reason I ask you that is, why would anyone in their right mind get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, travel across the country to Dublin to strike? I mean, can you tell people what this is about again?
Okay, well, it's about pensions, but it's also about bereavement leave and public service. We are not afforded public service status. We've been left out of those conditions, despite the fact that we are being paid by the Department of Education. We are still not regarded as public servants. and somebody else in the same office could be a public servant doing the same work in a public building, and we're not afforded the same.
And that's the crux of it, and that's why you went on the road, and that's why you strike today. School secretaries and caretakers, stay out with me, Esther. Jenny, you're a school principal. You were obviously affected by this today.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we fully support everybody today who stood out in to try and get pensions for themselves now, and parity of pensions as well. As Esther said there, it's all about fairness, and, you know, fairness for the same job that's being done at the same levels and the same grades across our civil and public service.
OK, so you support them, but what was it like in their absence today at school?
Manic. That's the only word that I can use to describe it. I mean, phones are not being answered, emails aren't being answered. We're panicking about how we're going to pay sub-teachers and sub-SNAs tomorrow, because that is the job of our wonderful secretaries in their school. You know, the amount of, it's such a busy time of the year as well, the amount of invoices are piling up as well, and they have to be paid, and, you know, our secretaries look after that. And I suppose an awful lot of people think that the role of the secretary is just answering phones and emails, but it really, really isn't.
So what happens then if somebody goes sick? What happens if somebody went sick in your school today, Jenny?
Well, I suppose the protocol in our school is that someone would contact me directly. If they're not going to be in, I source the sub, then I will tell the secretary who that sub is in for, and the secretary then, every Friday we do it in our school.
Go on,
excuse me, sorry.
Go on, go on.
Yeah, and they will put in the input to the department to say what sub is covering for what teacher, and based on that, payments are processed in 2 weeks' time.
But if I'm a sub in your school today, I'm not paid.
You won't be, no. No.
To hell with that, Jenny.
Because that is the role of the approver.
I mean, good luck getting subs.
I know, and this is a common crisis across the whole country, and all the other principals are in the same position as me. I feel like this is the unseen work that the secretaries do. Do you know, and this is why they need to be treated with fairness and to be treated with dignity.
Well, it sounds like a whole lot of extra work for the principal in my book, Jenny. Am I right?
Yeah, you would be. But that's all part of it. And without our secretaries, there is a huge amount of extra work for principals. And, you know, secretaries are wonderful, and they do so, so much to allow the teachers to continue doing their job and to provide uninterrupted teaching and learning for the children in the classroom.
Stay with me. They're the glue that keeps a lot of this together, I must say. Stay with me, Jenny. I have another principal on the line, but let me read to you. We've got a statement from the Department of Education and Youth, and all the school secretaries and all the caretakers on their way back to various positions around the country. This is what the department say. The Department of Education and Youth accepted an invitation from the Workplace Relations Commission to have exploratory talks and met with the WRC officials on Wednesday. It will continue to engage with all parties in the coming days, they say, including the Commission, who remain available to assist with the resolution of this dispute. The Department of Education and Youth is actively working with our education partners on putting in place contingency arrangements to minimise disruption and support the continuing of learning for all students. During this action, all schools are expected to open for all students. Do you know of any contingency operations arrangements, Jenny?
Well, I suppose we've been trying to do our own in-house contingency operations, which would be to keep parents informed as to what's happening. We have an in-house Aladdin system that we use to communicate with parents. So we're updating them, our parents, and letting them know what's happening, and hopefully our secretaries are going to be back as soon as possible.
Well, we'll see. It depends on the WRC. Stay with me, Jenny. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Not too bad. You're calling for the wonderful county of Galway, Gort. How did the strike affect Gort Community School today, Brian?
Well, I suppose it's not just the secretaries, it's the caretakers as well. And I have all of my caretakers and all of my secretaries are affected by this. So my board of management made a decision based on health and safety to have a reduced capacity in the school. So effectively, we have 2 year groups in when we should have quite a few more. So it's really curtailing the start of the year when it's an exciting time getting them all back in, settling them in, getting their timetables. And to have to tell a few year groups that you're not in today is a very difficult position to be put in. I 100% support the campaign. My issue with this is this is not something that happened today or yesterday. This has gone on a long time. And back in June, I was well aware that this strike action could possibly be happening.
Mm.
And talks, just, you know, they've laboured. They should never, it should never have come to this. It's a very difficult position that we're being put in.
Spool back there for a second, because I wanted to learn of the impact of this. I mean, if the secretaries or the caretakers aren't there, you said all of my secretaries and all of my caretakers. It sounds like you're running a campus as big as Harvard there in Gore Community School, Brian.
Well, I have 1,030 pupils, yes. I have 2 full-time secretaries and 2 part-time, and I have 2 full-time caretakers. So staff of over 110. So it's a massive operation.
Oh, Christ.
To be without your caretakers and your secretaries in a school of this size is extremely difficult. Everything Jenny said, I totally agree with her.
Yeah.
And Esther, I support her campaign. And it's a long way from Donegal, and I'm sure they got a good crew to come down to protest today.
I'd say so. Extremely difficult, you say. In what way? I mean, are the phones ringing? I mean, who's answering the phones there in Gore Community School?
If you just think of it like spillages, leaks, breakages, bins, toilets, security, front office. The front office is the heart of the school.
Mm.
It's one of the busiest times of the year. Parents are very anxious bringing in their first years in for the first time. They have to forget a lunch, forget gear bag. The phone is always ringing. It's constantly ringing. And even today, when your researcher there, Laura, was ringing me to try and get through to get onto a better connection, my phone mobile wasn't as good a connection.
Yeah.
The phone lines ring straight through to reception and then are passed on. We weren't able to do a direct line in, so I'm ringing you instead of you ringing me. That's just a small example of it.
Hang on a second here.
No parent can ring the school.
The school secretaries didn't tell us that this would impact Liveline. We can't get...
I know. Look, it's extremely stressful for us as senior management, and our caretakers and our secretaries are an integral part of school. They're such a big part of our school, and you know the front office is the heart of the school.
Mm.
Caretakers, they're not just caretakers; they're staff. They know the students well. They're out and about constantly, making sure, checking that there's no issues around the corridors, in the toilets, wherever. I actually met a staff member this morning and we were just chatting. She said her primary school has closed because her kids went in to start today, and after an hour there was a leak and everyone had to go home. So it's impacting schools all over the country, all in different ways. The issue is, if it goes on longer than a day or two, it is going to impact.
Let's say it goes on. It's not resolved in a week or two or three. How would that impact your school, Brian?
This is it, you know. I've had an emergency board meeting about this already, and I'm going to have another one tomorrow just to plan and see how can we survive, how can we keep the school functioning if this is a long term issue.
But you're not talking about reduced.
That's the reality for it.
But you're not talking about reduced capacity in your school for a week or two or three if this keeps going, are you?
Well, the department are on about, you know, giving supports to schools, but I haven't seen any of it. I haven't seen nobody offering me any supports. And, you know, we can't take on the roles or the duties of our secretaries and caretakers because we'd be in breach of our own unions then.
Mm. What supports? So the department have been in touch with... Have the department, have they been in touch in terms of supports for schools?
Well, we've got a letter from the department saying that schools should open as normal and to try and put contingency measures in place. But, I mean, there's only so much you can do to keep a school open. Yeah, you know, if it goes on for more than a few days, it does put us under serious pressure.
Yeah.
So I would be concerned that this might go on past Monday. Now, yesterday up till 6 o'clock, what we were hearing back was hopeful, but then negotiations broke down. I'm hoping that the department and DEEPER, after seeing the turnout in Dublin, see the amount of people that this is affecting, that they'll actually will start taking this a bit more seriously and try and get a resolution. For me, I can see that there will be a resolution. I can see that there is a case here. They have a very valid case for this to be addressed. And it will be. It will be solved. But will it be solved in a day? Will it be solved in a week? Will it be solved in a year? You know, we don't know.
Are you being ambitious? Brian, I know people in Gore are very ambitious, but are you being very ambitious to say that this could be done by Monday?
Look, at Forza just needs the department and DEEPER to come a small bit of the way to meet them, to allow the sectors and caretakers to go back to work in the knowledge that they know that this has been taken seriously and that it will be addressed and it will be sorted.
Jenny,
I don't think...
Yeah, stay with me. Jenny, did you get that letter from the department saying open as normal, we'll put contingencies in place?
Yes, something like that. Look, we're opening as normally as we possibly can. Yesterday, we had our new junior infant come in. I know, as what Brian was saying there, it is such an exciting time of the year and it's really fun and everybody's looking forward to the new year and to the new start. And we've got, you know, wonderful parents in our school who see and value the work that our secretaries do. And yes, I'm really, really hopeful that something can be organised over the weekend and our secretaries can return
sooner. And what if it isn't?
Well, sure. We did it during COVID when we didn't know what was going to happen, so we'll do it now too. We just may keep the doors open and keep the children in school. That's what we will be doing our best to do.
Does this remind you of COVID times, Jenny? Or is that a throwaway remark?
Yes.
Does it?
No, it does. It's really, really stressful. I mean, there's a lot of behind the scenes work that's been done by the secretaries in the school, which I alluded to before. Mm. I mean, even for example, on the 30th of September of this year, whatever figures are on our roll, that will determine our pupil-teacher ratio numbers and our teacher allocation for next September. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, we need to write to schools and send communications to schools, of which we've had inter-school transfers of pupils, to get those secretaries in the other schools to transfer the children over to us. And if we don't have the correct numbers on our books by the 30th of September, then this is going to have huge impact for the department in terms of primary planning and primary teaching for next year.
Well, can I go back to Noreen for a second? You're a school secretary. I mean, there is a certain feeling here. We know it from Liveline last week. People who said you knew what you were signing up for when you took the job as school secretary. Is there any fear that the public or the parents or the children or the teachers or the principals could turn on you, Noreen, you and school secretaries and caretakers, the longer this goes on?
I tell you now, Cormac, when I started my job, it was 150 students. And now it's 400 students and the role has changed. It's a professional job. I think that's actually rubbish. I feel sorry for those two principals. I know how they're feeling and I know that they have got excellent staff. I would know that personally that they have excellent staff and I feel sorry for the principals. They have enough stress going on in their lives. They need to teach and not be doing our work. And they're brilliant not to do it. And I know that they're supporting it. Our jobs have changed phenomenally over the years. And I think actually the COVID remark kind of brings back memories because we were yet again at the coalface of that and giving out books in plastic bags and to parents through the window. And it's definitely bringing back memories of that. And, you know, we need to be valued and the gap is just too wide at the moment. And this could be solved if the Department of Education, A, could tell us why they're not giving us a pension and B, put it in writing that, yes, we're going to give them pensions and we need to talk about it and to sit down with our officials. The door is open.
Well, it's all at the WRC.
Not blaming us.
Yeah, it's all at the WRC. Yeah. But just to recap, Noreen, this is a strike of indefinite duration. You're resolved to be in this for the long haul, are you?
We sure are, because we, you know what, we're sick of writing nice letters. We're sick of being patient. Enough is enough. Time is ticking and we need it now.
Okay, look, back to the chanting for you on the bus home, Noreen. Thanks for talking to us. Thanks for calling us. Esther, thank you. Jenny, thank you. Brian, thank you.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You and your friends must be insane.
yeah, I suppose we are a little bit. That's what most people say to us. But
so you've just finished this. No. You've just finished, I'm told. Is that right?
That's it, yeah. I literally got back there 2 days ago. The race finished Saturday at midday. So, yeah, very fresh. The body's still feeling it. So
The body is sore as hell. Tell people what you did.
Yeah, so myself and five friends, we done the Speed Project in France. Which Speed Project is basically an unsanctioned, no rules relay race, ultramarathon relay race, where a team of six people essentially in the French version, run from Chamonix to Marseille in France in a relay format, one person running at all times. And the route can be whatever you want. You just have to get from Chamonix to Marseille as quickly as possible, essentially.
That's so nuts, because I'm putting it in here to my GPS. Am I right in saying that could be over 400 kilometres?
Yeah, we ended up doing about 465 kilometres in total, yeah, over the... It took us about 32 and a half hours.
You took a left. So. You took a left to go to the toilet, David, is that it?
Yeah, we took a few wrong lefts and wrong rights, to be honest with you. Yeah.
So why have I not heard of this before? You say unsanctioned and no rules. What kind of a race is this?
Yeah, so I suppose that's why it kind of attracted us as well and kind of woke up my eye, but... It was set up by Niels, who's the founder, and him and a few friends, I think it was 12 years ago, decided to run from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, which is where it was founded, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then from there, they kind of kept this kind of, I suppose, cryptic and kind of low-key race, and that was kind of the selling point for us. So you essentially can, there's no public link to get in. It's basically most people get invited into the race, or you can try, I suppose, which is what I don't beg your way to get the application link and then hope that you get accepted.
So you have to get an invite. Tell me this. You came, where did you place? There were nearly 40 teams altogether, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was just under 40 teams. We came fourth out of that, which was...
Wow.
Yeah, it was a good result, to be fair, considering it was our first time as well. Most teams have done a few of these. So they're well used to, you know, the whole logistical side of things. So we were delighted with that, to be honest.
You're all elite athletes, David, are you?
I definitely wouldn't call us that at all, to be honest. No, I think we really try to compete with heart, I think, and just not willing to give up more than anything, to be honest. The lads absolutely smashed it now, yeah. So.
Well, you're more than park runners, I can tell you that much. Where are you from? Where are you all from? You and six of you all together.
Six of us all together, yeah. So I'm from Kilkenny, and then we had half the team. Sorry, the other four lads in the team are from up north, so Derry, Monaghan,
wow,
up that side of the world, and then we had one fellow on the team from Kildare.
Okay. Did you all know each other beforehand?
We did, yeah. So most of us are based in Dublin for work, and we all know each other, I suppose, in different aspects. But for example, like myself and Ben, one of the lads, we only knew each other kind of for the last 2 years, but, you know, we're extremely close. We kind of do all these kind of mad things together, and whenever I ask him to do something or he asks me to do something, it's kind of like a yes and don't ask questions, and then it ends up being a great time.
I'm getting reports as well of, or I'm hearing that you were very loud arriving to Marseille Beach, that there was a loud, mad group of Irishmen. Is that true?
Yeah, it was something like that. I think, we were quite vocal coming in. I suppose, like, we had, I'm not going to lie, the last few hours of the race, the last bit of the race, it was quite, I suppose, tough, and we were kind of just put the heads down, and we were just kind of slogging through it. So I think once we saw the finish line was at the beach, basically, we all had to run into the water. I think when we saw that, we were just like, I think the sense of relief just kind of hit, all this was overwhelming. Like, we were just literally screaming and shouting as we were running into the beach, so we definitely caught a bit of attention from
the beach.
Yeah.
Where are you now? Are you still in Marseille?
No, I'm at home. I'm back in the work life in Dublin at the moment.
Okay, so, in Dublin. Come here. Yeah, I need a package picked up in Cork later on this evening. You wouldn't run down.
if you pay me enough, I'd be tempted. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, look, congratulations to you. It's an incredible, insane, adventurous and exciting story. David, more people like you in the world is what we need, I think. Congratulations to you and your friends. Thank you.
Lifeline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Joan, I think, is on the line. You're a school secretary, Joan. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm retired.
You're retired.
I'm a retired secretary.
Well, you're very much in solidarity. Go on, what's your point, please?
I am very much in solidarity. My point is this would be solved in no time if the principals and the teachers really supported the secretaries, close the schools, get out there and stand with them, not just behind the gates saying we'll get contingencies or whatever. I've heard it for years. We're so good and our secretaries are great and our caretakers. Get out, close the schools, and it'll be solved. So I guarantee you.
Teachers and principals on strike as well?
Teachers and principals. Well, why not?
Chaos, if we're Joan. Chaos.
No, solidarity. The teachers have been well able to go on strike themselves, you know, for their own needs. I've best friends, teachers.
Yeah.
But if the secretaries and the caretakers are so precious and they're so good, and I've been hearing this all along, I worked with great people in school, but this is the way you solve it. This is going on. I joined the school in 1982. I was lucky to be in a scheme where I have got a pension and I got great entitlements. That changed. In actual fact, it was taken from us. Those arrangements were there at one stage. So if they really support us, get out, close the school, and it'll be solved.
Okay, you've heard the praise before from teachers and principals. You say it's time for action now. Go on strike. That's a call to action. Joan, thank you very much indeed.